The Billion Transaction Machine, das kleine Einmaleins des Mainframes.
Diese Podcast-Folge ist auf Englisch und eine Spezialausgabe rund um das Thema Digital Assets. Außerdem ist sie länger als unser gewohntes Format und bietet daher auch tiefere Einblicke in das Thema. Welcome to episode number 4 of our Linux One podcast season. My name is Leon and this episode is all around digital assets. I have two experts by my side. Welcome Corpierre and welcome Florian. I'm happy that you're part of the season, and before we take a look at the current market situation for digital assets, let's start with a quick introduction from your side.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. My name is Corpierre Georg. I'm the director of the Frankfurt School Blockchain Center. Before joining Frankfurt School in 2024, I was at the University of Cape Town for 10 years and had sort of the most epic deal with Bundesbank, where I spent 3 months a year in Frankfurt at Bundesbank and then 9 months a year in Cape Town, sort of eternal summer, always working on payments and sort of as blockchain came up then on blockchain and digital assets.
Right. Hey, thanks for having me here on this podcast. So my name is Florian Noll. I'm the director for our IBMZ, ISV and GSI ecosystem. So basically everything about the relationship with our software vendors and our system integrators to drive the adoption and the modernization of our mainframe platform, including the whole topics from core banking to digital assets, as well as anything related to infrastructure. So thanks for having me and looking forward to talk about what we have in store about digital assets and what we have been doing over the last 10 years.
Perfect. Thanks for the introduction then. So I would say let's dive straight into it, looking at the current market situation and the stablecoin market. So what's your take here?
You wanna start? I'm happy to start off to give a sort of a skeptical take.
Let me start from a university perspective. You know,
I
know a lot about regulation, and I think I can then take over where I see the developments from the enterprise.
Yeah, so for economists, it's always tricky, right? Because we manage to be both late and slow, and when we talk about these things, but there's a couple of sort of points that economic research is starting to learn around stablecoins. And I think for me, it's always to start with, okay, what are stablecoins used for? There's this narrative and idea that there's remittances. But when you talk to sort of practitioners, they tell me it's like 5% of transaction volume is that, and 95% is crypto arbitrage. Which is fine. Arbitrage is information production. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But if that's the use case for stablecoins, that really changes how both European stablecoins could position themselves. It changes sort of how we should look at stablecoins. And my take is, don't look at it as a product. Let's look at it from the perspective of infrastructure. If this is infrastructure to ensure that prices on crypto exchanges are sort of price differences are arbitraged away, that's great. But then I would look at this more from the perspective of critical market infrastructure, and the regulation we currently have for stablecoins is worlds apart from how we regulate critical market infrastructure. It's a completely different view on this. And there's a little bit of a disconnect that has economists very, and I just want to highlight like two small things, right, that are discussed in academia. One is this whole question of redemptions. If I have a bank deposit, I can go to my bank, and when I think, maybe the bank is in trouble, I can go there and redeem, and the bank has deposit insurance up to 100,000 euros in the euro area. But basically, this balance of deposit insurance that eliminates bank runs and some fragility that incentivizes the bankers to be cautious is a decent balance from an economic incentive perspective, to say this system sort of works and we understand why. With stablecoins, I can't go to Tether in a normal situation and redeem myself. Tether is, from where I'm sitting, a super shady institution with unclear reserves, with unclear ownership structures, without a proper attestation from from the accountants. There's lots of intransparency, and if there's a concern about Tether, it starts to depeg. I couldn't go to them, so I would have to go to a crypto exchange, but the crypto exchange depends on Tether functioning. That is the kind of sort of vicious cycles that keep economists who think about financial stability up at night. Because everything we've learned about incentives, the Nobel Prize for Economics, I think 2016 or so, not so long ago, was awarded for Diamond and Dybvig for their analysis of bank run models. We know how to model these things. And we know that Tether in particular does not have a well-understood redemption mechanism. That is a source of grave concern. The other one is this idea of one leg out multi-issuance. It's like you have a US stablecoin like Circle. They have they are regulated in the EU under MiCA. The same smart contract that issues USDC in the US also issues USDC in Europe. If there is concerns in the US, not about Circle, they're going to be fine. I actually think that as far as stablecoins go, Circle is pretty much up there. But you have under Genius all these state-level regulated stablecoins where we are not sure if, just picking Wyoming because they are very liberal about this, if the three people doing stablecoin regulation in Wyoming actually have the same kind of bandwidth and capacity to really look into Frontier or into like stablecoins from Wyoming, and they would be accepted in the EU. If ever there's risk there and there's a run on a stablecoin in the US, they would drain the European reserves. And that incentivizes European investors to run on a stablecoin. Again, that's one of these sort of vicious circles that we understand in economics, and where we thought after the last crisis, lesson learned, we are not doing that again. And it feels like here we are on the merry-go-round sort of trying to explain again why we have learned all these things and that we really should, you know, put in place a different regulation or a different environment within which these stablecoins operate. So that's the sort of economics, why we are concerned more than enthusiastic about stablecoins.
And Kopia, I think you're building, you know, the bridges between regulation, research, and our real use cases, right? And what we have lately seen, I believe, is that with Tether, Circle, stablecoins are more than just, you know, a payment or cross-border technology level, right? It's also gives you as a country, as a state, as a geography, certain kind of control. And I think an answer is that lots of banks, lots of consortiums are now getting built, especially in the EU, but also on in other geographies where I believe regulation to a certain kind is there, and you feel empowered to start to build, right? And there is an idea to release your own stable coins in your own currency. And even if you're not doing it, there will be markets based on US dollar stable coins. And then banks, payment providers, they have to react. They need to implement this new infrastructure. So from an enterprise perspective, I think the year last year has shown that with the volumes of stable coins and the velocity of stable coins, which is higher than traditional money, and with the cost of transacting stable coins, which is way lower, and the friction that you remove from the system, you need to implement this. And that's why I think the convergence between traditional systems and these crypto systems or crypto rails is mainly driven right now by this idea of stable coins and how easy this is to use, right? And therefore,
I agree.
And therefore, I think the conclusion right now that I see is how fast can we, and by we I say each different country, each different bank in a certain country, how fast can you react and be part of this ecosystem, or will certain players take over, and are these players the existing players that we have seen, or are these completely new players? You will see new payment chains that are evolving right now, which are competing with existing chains. And I think right now we see popping up new chains everywhere. Everywhere wants to have a part of the pie. Soon, I believe there is again consolidation here, and we'll see some more focus on dedicated projects, right?
Do you think that's something that when we had these discussions with central banks around CBDC, one of the points we always made was to say, well, if you want to ensure monetary sovereignty, you need to have infrastructure that allows sort of all this digital value creation, which increasingly takes place, to actually happen on your rail, and your legacy systems, quote unquote, are not conducive to that. So you need to think as a central bank, you need to think from your core mandate about the infrastructure that you put in place. The one concern that we always had in these discussions was if you have a stablecoin world, what prevents the creation from walled gardens? Right, we've seen this back in, I'm not going to say when I was young, but because that predates me, but like back in the 70s, you had these internet service providers. When the internet was built, they had their own standards, they had their own cables. I remember when I was a student, I worked at our computing center as an intern. We had these token ring, the yellow cables that would go. It was an alternative to Ethernet, and this is not that long ago, as you might think, right? So there is this, like in the history of technology development, we have seen these trends towards little walled gardens competing with one another. And with stablecoins, I was always fearful that this is what we are seeing, right? That instead of having sort of competition on like what is the best open standard, we get into a world where they're competing for who can enclose the most. And then how do we get interoperability? How do we ensure that? Isn't it possibly easier to do this via, and that's the alternative in Europe, is this idea of a CBDC, central bank digital currency. Is that a way to ensure this interoperability? Is it a way to ensure that banks will face a level playing field because they are at an informational disadvantage over big tech these days? Or do we do it as the US does with regulation, clear stablecoin regulation? What's the better way? Do you think this concern is sort of purely academic, or is it something that you share?
I think the last 9 years when DeFi took over for a certain time, you could assume that this will drive fully into a decentralized decentralized methodologies, decentralized collaboration. But I think over the last years, what we have seen is that this also has a lot of fraud. There's lots of fraud. There's lots of bad players. And you are almost, it's very hard to protect yourself, right? So you cannot just throw away what we have learned over the last, periods of hundred of years where we have built on our economy. And I think whether you're using a CBDC or a stablecoin, there is lots of foundational processes, business automation workflows that have to be adopted, which then both rely on an infrastructure that is somehow powering digital asset rails. So I think right now, it's not about making a decision between one or the other. It's a decision to build this infrastructure that will power both cases to a certain extent, and then we'll see how they work together and how they will empower economies. Yeah? And I think this close correlation between AI and agentic AI and agentic wallets, how they will make use of certain stable coins, for example, to act independently and execute tasks and transactions. I'm not sure how fast we get there with a CBDC versus, for example, a stablecoin today. Innovation, speed, and velocity will drive lots of these use cases. Even though they're not going into like broader production, we will learn a lot right now. And those infrastructures that are getting built right now are the ones that are going to be used most likely in the next years. And right now, what I can see is you have all of the tier one, tier two banks, payment providers driving integration, either it's via modules and enabling digital asset rails, or they're really jumping fully onto it and creating their own products and helping their clients, for example, creating new yields using tokenized deposits, tokenized money markets. I think they're money market funds. So I think there is we're no longer in the phase where you have to lecture any player in the market. I think we have done a good job over the last 7 years. Now it's about how to teach them to use the infrastructure that's out there and help to build joint visions and joint projects.
I agree. I've seen a shift in people don't need to talk about technology design anymore. They need to talk about business cases. Like, what is the business case that you have in front of you? Why should you invest? And in the past, it was always the case that you had every bank, they had their projects and on digital assets and this and that. It was always innovation teams doing this. And I was always very skeptical of that because it means it doesn't really have buy-in within the institution to be serious about the transformation. And that has markedly shifted. Now it's a little less exciting because it's not frontier anymore, but you get to deal with compliance, which I consider a good thing because it means that's like where things get serious. If the compliance officer is in the room and you have to discuss with them, like that's when it gets closer to the customers. What I've been wondering about over the past years is, I've heard like 5 years ago, people talking about tokenization, just to pick one example. I think tokenization has great potential. There's really amazing things you can do with it. Cut costs, you know, create liquidity, integrated European capital market. There's a unique opportunity in front of us through new rails to achieve an objective, which politically we have failed to achieve for 25 years or so. I think that's an opportunity, but I go to these conferences and workshops today and I hear still people talk about how in 5 years it's all going to be different and tokenization has taken off. So I was left a bit disappointed in the current state of how far have we come. I had thought we would have been much further. Meanwhile, in Switzerland, for example, the adoption is not as quick as we had hoped, even though they have a great regulatory environment. They have a very understanding banking system, very short distances, right? It's a bit more sluggish than what I think many people had hoped 5 years ago, given how awesome tokenization is. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you see as well? Or is it where you just say, well, you know, we're still just before the hockey stick kicks in and it's hard to see that the hockey stick is around the corner?
I think Switzerland is a good example. Low interest rates, high innovation power, high salaries, lots of international talent. But you're not developing for your own market, right? You do a lot of development for other geographies. And I think the appetite is not too high because there is such an efficient system in place. So we are very much saturated with the system, and you may not need to change, right? But if you look at the US, where you have high interest rates, where there is even more friction, it's even more complicated, and I think they have just another scale, right? And the scale is also what sometimes drives this appetite and this innovation. On the other side, you know, we have been in this. So from an IBM side, we have been in building infrastructures for private keys now for over 10 years, and one of the initial ideas was how can we really create a platform to secure private keys, right? So in the term of cold storage, right? Lately, what I have been seeing is there is so many different definitions of cold storage where I believe we lost a little bit the feeling for it because the scalability that we expect it has not yet kicked in, so we have not yet seen big cold storage platforms fail, right? But one thing that we have been building with partners, cold storage custody partners, but also tier one, tier two banks, was empowering their own solutions. And over the last 2 to 3 years, I've seen that even these banks are now starting to realize the complexity of building a full end-to-end digital asset platform means that there is a lot of friction today because you have so many different players with great platforms, you know, from blockchain pricing, Oracle data, to understanding smart contracts and preventing exploits, or even realizing if there is an exploit that could happen. And then going to tokenization engines, and they are popping up everywhere, right? And then you got 40 plus and more blockchains, and so this interoperability is hard. But that basic problem of safekeeping a private key, which is at the end of the day a modern custodian for digital assets, I think lots of attention needs now here to be fixed, to fix that problem once for all, right? Because this is where I think it starts, and you can somehow build all the rest on top of it. And that's I think something that what I see lots of this markets, in whether it's in Switzerland or in the US or from APEC to Japan, lots of these banks are doing right now. So they're preparing right now for that next step. So tokenization will then really kick off once I believe this is really in place.
Yeah, I hope that's the missing piece and not something. For me, it was always the first step was, as you say, keep keys safe, have custody. But the even bigger challenge is provide these keys where needed, right? So why is DeFi brilliant? Because it's the first time I've seen us being able to do something that a limit order book would do without having to have the keys. So why does limit order book work? Because your order is sitting there, and when the matching or like when it's filled, whoever holds your key, they can execute. If you want, it means you provide your key to somebody else. If you want to keep the keys private to yourself, we need to find a different mechanism. And DeFi is with the token bonding curves, like back in the days, and then later becoming automated market makers. It's the first time that we have sort of threaded that needle in the right way, so that we can do functionality without having to have the keys available. I wonder though, is there something that you see on the horizon as an alternative? One thing we've looked into is trust execution environments where you have a similar trade-off, right? Assuming, like with all the bad things you can say about TEs, assuming there's a way to address many of these threat surfaces, you have a chance to store a key, proving that you can't access it and still provide it in a pre-agreed way. Is that something that you see, or have you also seen other sort of approaches to this?
I think the market has well adopted MPC, multi-party computing, for kind of get access to keys for signing. There is the aspect of the whole governance and policy layer you need to have in place. And I think here, the more granular you can go, the better you can also comply with any type of regulation, and audits, right? When you're referring to confidential computing and trusted execution environments, I think it's also very much a protecting your own administrators, right? So to bring in technical assurance, right? And this is exactly something we have been promoting over the last years, not only in the digital asset space, but in the broader community, when we talk about confidential computing, and you can go as far as protecting AI models. But in this case, last year we released a new product, which is Item Haven, right? And this is a frictionless end-to-end digital asset platform. And one part that we have always been proud of was how we handle offline signing, right? So we really have true cold storage, and that means that it will never get online. You have your HSMs really in an offline air-gap mode, right? And typical systems that we have seen in the past mean would rely on lots of manual interactions, whether you go from one or the other room, or you have some administrators with manual interventions to really drive that signing. So automating this full process while keeping it secure, I think that has been a game changer that the market needs to adopt actually from a cold storage perspective to power all these use cases, right? So what I believe is having that in place, and that will be my question to you. Yeah, you were speaking about tokenization. We spoke about stable coins. I think let's keep the regulation aside right now. What's the next big thing a client, and when I say a client, a user, will experience with that technology? What's going to impact us in the next 3 to 6 months, if I can say so?
Well, 3 to 6 months, that's tougher. Like, yeah, 3 to 6 months, I don't know. But one thing that I'm very excited about is the idea of tokens as digital property rights. So where you build data infrastructures where data, where the nature of data is changed. Right now, data is a non-rival good, meaning you can sort of, when you have access to it, you can copy it basically for free, which means you can create infinite supply, which means it's really hard to create marketplaces for data. And I think we've seen that. At the same time, individuals don't really have control over their data, because if you want to do data analytics over pools of data, everybody has to give their data away. I think there's technology around the corner that changes that, where you can sort of combine data, encrypt it, license the use of this encrypted data to third parties where they get the result of their analysis, but not the data itself. If you set up an infrastructure like that, and that's something that my group is very actively working on, that's sort of our most exciting sort of thing we do in the office around here, you can change the nature of data itself into something that is relational and not just despotic, in the sense that right now whoever controls the data decides what you do with it. And that means we've accepted many sort of weird trade-offs. We've accepted that data is narrowly accessible to few people. And once you have access, you can do everything with it. I think it should be exactly the other way around. Data should be more openly accessible to a broad number of people who can do very few things with it, meaning only the things that you've decided. And with blockchain and with tokens, you can set up systems where tokens encode digital rights. And you can start trading these tokens. You can start allocating them. You can start setting incentives to source authentic human-generated data, because for the first time, you are able to have revenue sharing from data processors with the data creators. I think that's, for me, that's where I see the true potential of blockchain, where tokenization could go. Think of NFTs, which, you know, have very limited use. But think of that as a layer to create digital property. We don't have that. There's no digital property rights right now. If we can create a digital economy with a true property right regime, imagine when you go back in history what this has done to humanity when we created property rights for the first time, the economic benefits that this had. And we've never had that for cyberspace. And only now we are seeing sort of that transition being possible. That's for me the most exciting thing, to think about like a completely different version of cyberspace itself, with true property rights, true humans getting the right incentives, no more expropriation of data, no more fake news. Like a lot of the ills that we see have come from cyberspace, you can address in a way like that. Yeah, you realize that's for me super exciting.
Digital assets goes way beyond stable coins, way beyond what we just discussed in the beginning, right? And empowerment of each individual person, I think that could be a good summary of what you just said, right? You can control data. And I've personally worked on some of these use cases with sports, yeah, where you own certain capabilities and maybe the neuro data of how you behave in certain situations, it's worth monetizing it. Yeah. So I think clearly the need, what you just described, for data producers, data consumers, and create an incentive in this system, right? So I think that could be another topic for another podcast, I assume. I think we're having a minute left. I think from a IBM perspective, I think we're really happy to be in this space right now, because we have been for the last 50-60 years with working with banks on core banking and payment systems, and digital assets now is a very natural step towards an economy where you can empower the individuals, right? And I think if we get into a point that we can give access via the same ways we do it today in a traditional sense to this crypto economy, I think then we achieve what it's needed to empower in a broader scale.
Yeah, completely agreed.
Yeah, thanks guys for sharing all these valuable information. And thanks for also hopping on the season. I think it was a great episode. But before we finish, I want to also highlight that we have two events here, which are worth also to highlight. First, we have Introduction to Digital Asset Haven webinar coming up 3rd of March. And also wanted to highlight the Crypto Asset Conference hosted from the Frankfurt School Blockchain Center, March 25. So make sure to secure your ticket here. And if you want any more information, keep the discussion open, contact us over LinkedIn. All information are in the show notes. And then thanks for listening and see you in the next episode.